Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name's Sammy James. Welcome to the show. Today we'll be looking back at Tuesday night's 3-1 defeat to Nottingham Forest at the City Ground. Was it our worst performance of the season? It was certainly up there, particularly that opening 45 minutes. All the fallout from everything that happened up north. And then we'll be looking ahead to Saturday's game against Newcastle United. Thank God at Craven Cottage. Anything to spare us another away defeat. I'm joined by Jack Collins. Hello.
Hello, Sammy. How you doing?
Good, thank you. And fresh back from Nottingham, his train literally screeched in about 10 minutes ago, it feels like. George Cooper, hello.
Hello, Sammy.
Long away day.
I know. Bit weary, travel weary. It wasn't one for the archives, put it that way.
Yeah, it was a pretty shocking performance. Jack, it's been a little while, but could we do some three-word reviews, please?
Some excellent ones. I enjoyed this from Paul Budd. He says, Copacabana calls cottages. Jordan
Pfeiffer. That feels about six words.
Yeah,
but
I mean, look, it's just one of those, isn't it? Jordan Pfeiffer says one word, Fulhamish. Fulham, Minnesota with treehouse horror. Black, White and Fred said rinsed and repeated. Fulham DC with Brentford relegation project, which I did really enjoy.
Shout out Dane.
And Ross McSweeney. Shouts out Ross. Hope he's doing well. Hollow Fulham away. Truly excellent. Love that.
George, as you were there in the away end yesterday, was it as bad in person as it looked on the television?
Yep. First half especially, the worst first half performance we've had all season by far. I was hoping that after the Sheffield United game, the fact that we managed to scrape a draw against a team of that calibre, and I think we gave Sheffield a bit too much credit. We didn't show up. I didn't think we were going to be as good as they turned out to be. I think there was a bit of swagger and arrogance maybe, and we got caught short. I was hoping that we would learn from that performance and come out and be really attentive and well-drilled and play with an intensity. And it's just nothing at all. Forest wanted it more. They were up for it. They played like a team who were fighting for their lives, and they thoroughly, thoroughly deserved the win. I don't think anyone can argue. We were just terrible. Defensively, sloppy. The work rate, poor. So wasteful in possession, especially in the midfield. And I think the triple substitution on the 32nd minute sort of said it all. It was a really, really terrible performance. That's not to say that Forest weren't good. They were very good. They played, as I said, like a team fighting for their lives. They attacked incredibly well. Morgan Gibbs-White was just unplayable at times, caused us all sort of problems. But yeah, it was a really, really, really poor performance. And I expect and I hope for a big response against Newcastle on Saturday, because it just wasn't good enough, to be honest.
No, I mean, Jack, George says that Forest were playing like a team that wanted it more, but I mean, quite obviously they wanted it more. And as much as, you know, we can say, well, you know, footballers get paid enough, motivation shouldn't be a factor. You look at Forest's fixtures for the rest of the season, particularly at home. This was a big beacon of you must win this if you want to stay in the league. Like, they haven't got the easiest home fixtures to come. We know they've always been pretty terrible on the road, so are we. So,
and not as bad as us.
Yeah. I'm not excusing Fulham's performance. It was poor, but at the same time, just sometimes you come up against a team at the wrong time, and especially when that place under the floodlights gets rocking, it's a really, really hard place to play football.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. Don't let it get rocking. You know, you can see what that means to the team.
to the fans, to all of it. And like you say, it felt like the one sort of must win. So the things you don't do in those situations is concede early, let them build up any momentum, let them get a foot on the board and control the game and find the spaces that they did. Now, so there's various things. I saw Tom Kenny say afterwards, he was like, I can't put my finger on what this is. And he talked about complacency and basically not allowing the season to peter out and being important that Fulham are able to find important closing moments. But equally, I think that there was various things wrong tactically yesterday. And I said after, you know, a couple of games, and especially after the Tottenham game, that I think it was important not to try and overreact for the rest of the season. We're in a really good position. We're in a position that a lot of teams of our similar stature would be relatively envious of. And so that there is a kind of level of, I think Jack Kelly tweeted yesterday saying like, oh no, anyway, to this period of the season, which in some ways is lovely. But as George says, it did feel like it just wasn't there last night at all from the get-go. And tactically, the spaces that we allowed Forest to open up, I have no idea. And I very rarely criticise Joao Palhinha because he's been so good and so, you know, consistent for Fulham across his tenure. I have no idea what he was trying to do or what Silva was trying to do, perhaps, with his positioning on the field, because he was trying to push up and snap into tackles, and the spaces it left behind for Morgan Gibbs-White to start to get on the ball. And the last thing you want in the world is a player like that having freedom and confidence to start to execute things. And you saw as the half progressed, Morgan Gibbs-White went from playing erratic balls into the path of Anthony Robinson to dummying players, to spinning out of pressure. That's a player who's gone, oh, I've got the space to open up here. And it was because we were so high that there was just a gap. And then the fullbacks, who we praised after the Tottenham game for being so high and being aggressive and pushing on, there are games where that works. There are also games where it doesn't. You have to be able to adjust in game if that's not working. We were terrorised down both flanks. Now, Robinson has the pace to get back and did so on multiple occasions.
I thought Robinson wasn't that bad yesterday.
No, Robinson was fine. But, you know, the actual spaces in behind him were still there. He's just got that capability athletically to get into those spaces and retract and manage to cover. Kenny Tete, on the other hand, I hesitate again to criticise heavily because of, I think it's easy to forget how good he was last year and how important he was to this Fulham side. And I don't know if this is a tactical instruction from Marco Silva, but he was so high up and unable to get back time and time and time and time again. And it just felt like Forrest, every time they got the ball, were like, just stick it in behind, let Callum Hudson-Odoi run to it. And it worked over and over and over again. At that point, you've got to be able to adjust. And I think that's what's frustrating. And look, Coop's mentioned it. You get to the weekend, we concede three against Sheffield United, who, again, right, scrapping for their lives, fine. But you concede three against the basement side, you scrap a draw out of it. And it was a roller coaster. There was a lot of emotion. We had a lot of fun with the last minute equaliser. Great. All good. You then surely can't have the same thing happening again in, you know, 3 days later against another side fighting for their life. You have to learn. And it felt like Fulham learned nothing from the weekend and took that into this game, just kind of with the attitude of it will probably be fine. I tweeted being with the gif from Barbie. It was like, my job is just beach. It does feel like that bit, yeah, right now.
You've also, obviously, it was during the Sheffield United game where you tweeted it first, but it very much applied here that Fulham have become the Robin Hood of the Premier League.
Which of the Sherwood Forest, it felt apt.
Yeah,
it?
Particularly apt, given what happened. And maybe there was a case of, like, the Rodrigo Muniz, you know, scissor kick, and the fact that we nearly won that game, you know, brushed over so many of the cracks that was that Sheffield United game. But also I think you could be excused for thinking that Sheffield United was a bit of a one-off, bit of a off afternoon.
Blip, yeah.
This is looking like more of a concerning thing. George, I wanted to come on to, we kind of addressed him there lightly, Kenny Tete.
Mm.
It wasn't his night. I don't think you need us to tell you that. But I cannot understand how this is the same player that we watched last year. He must just be struggling for fitness so badly, because this was a player that was the best one-on-one fullback in the Premier League. And literally within 5 minutes, Callum Hudson-Odoi done him about three times, did him for the first goal. He looked like he was really, really struggling. And maybe this wasn't the game to bring him back in hindsight.
Yeah, it was a straight up, well, it certainly seemed to me he's just not match fit at all. And it, manifests in so many elements of his game. It was, he was getting caught out of possession. As Jack said, he was really, really slow to get back into position. And it was just a lack of urgency, it seems. So he'd get dispossessed. This happened in the first 15 minutes. And then he's tracking back. And you think, if you lose the ball as a fullback, you are busting a gut to get back into position because you know there's going to be all sorts of trouble happening in the final third. He was almost like jogging back and looked to be seriously, seriously blowing. And I'm hoping that that's the case, that it's a fitness issue rather than the fact that he just, I don't know, he's just not as motivated before, which I'm sure isn't the case. But he really struggled. And as you said, for the goal, you know, Callum Hudson-Odoi just drops the shoulder. It's so simple. And like, you think of last season's gone by, one-on-one, he's blocking that every single time. And
well, who can forget the Chelsea performance where literally Mikhailo Mudryk is still in his pocket and it's been like 18 months.
But it was also, you know, the shift from, look, Hudson-Odoi is a really good player. And it, you know, sometimes when you, in the last couple of years, we've forgotten, I think, how talented he is and how good he is one-on-one and making things happen. But it's not like he has to work incredibly hard to create that little space to shoot in the first half. It's one shift out of his feet when it's pretty much static. It should be something that a defender of Tete's caliber can read. And it just felt like almost everything was out of kilter. And I think it feeds back into what George is saying.
Kane really, really flattered Hudson-Odoi for that goal. He makes him look like prime Ronaldo, and he had so much to do when he got in possession. He took it from outside the box. He gassed him down the line, had so much time when he cut inside, and even the shot, it's just the reactions. He was really, really off the boil. And I love Tete. I really do. And I really hope that he stays. I think he's been one of my favourite players for Fulham over the years. And yesterday, hopefully it's just a bad performance and he can regain a bit of fitness, regain a bit of confidence. But yeah, it was a real stinker from him, I have to say.
I mean, Jack, I guess this is a slight disadvantage of the whole, you know, two good players in each position, because Kenny Tete is a good right back. We know this. And Timmy Castagna has rightly taken his place. And Marco's brought in Tete probably for a little bit of rotation, probably to keep Kenny happy, maybe to give Tim Castagna a little bit of a breather. But this is, you know, it's hard to keep everyone fit, motivated, completely match sharp. Yeah. Unless you have lots of games, like if you're in Europe or whatever, but we don't have that luxury.
No, we don't. And I think maybe we were able to gloss over it a little bit with the amount of cup competitions that were going on early on. Look, if we come up against five injuries, and back where we were in January with players missing and players absent, we were talking about expanding this squad. Now we're leaving match fit players out of the 18. Right. So we are at a point where it does feel that we're slightly lucky in some ways that we haven't got any injuries. That might be manifesting itself in different problems for Marco Silva, but it's probably a testament to Fulham's medical team as well. So that shouldn't be given, you know, that shouldn't be glossed over. It does make it difficult. And I think that there is an element here where there's lots of different things going on. Tete hasn't been in the team, as you say. I think the fact that he was given 90 minutes is interesting when there was a lot of players pulled. And Marco did say afterwards about the fact that he'd made the triple substitution. He was like, actually wasn't really anything about those three players. It was just, we needed to change it and it needed wholesale changes to try and shift the momentum of the match. And I thought that was an interesting comment and one which maybe takes the edge off the pain that those players will have been feeling. Harry Wilson in particular felt incredibly bad for, given the reception that he'd got as a former Derby player at Nottingham Forest. For him to be pulled early was brutal. But equally, you do look at it and think, well, that's, you know, what you've got to do, what you've got to do. So hard, difficult one, incredibly tough night for Kenny Tete. I think everybody will expect Castagna to be back in at the weekend. But it's a hard one in terms of, he got that 90 minutes, I think, to try and get him into some sort of match fitness for later in the season.
I will just say on the Harry Wilson point, yes, he got a negative reception, but he's one of those players where there are very few teams where he doesn't get a negative reception from the crowd, just given how many teams that he's played
for. It's
a fair point. Yeah, Evertonians, he gets it from.
This felt quite visceral, though, in particular, I think.
Swansea, he gets it from. Yeah, he gets like a lot.
Yeah, no, I did feel for those three substitutes. And I think, honestly, if Marco could have changed all 11 players at that point, I think he would have considered it. It was that bad. George, the second goal was bloody weird. It must have felt even weirder in the stadium. Chris Wood's goal.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it had shades a little bit of the one that Andreas Pereira scored for Fulham earlier in the season against Arsenal. And you're like, a what? I thought someone had pressed R2 on Bernd Leno. Where was he? It was so odd. I mean, it was well taken. In fairness.
It was very well taken. I think, I believe Bassi could have maybe got a little bit tighter to him to just prevent him.
Don't think he
that
expected
space.
The shot, did he? I mean, it was kind of.
I don't think anyone does. To be fair to Leno.
And the only, as soon as it goes in, you just think, okay, well, Leno's not got sight on it, and he wasn't expecting it. He just was completely rooted to the spot. And I think it was just a very clever, opportunistic finish from Woods. And yeah, weird. It was from miles out as well. It was one of the, like, all of our defence was just thinking, how the hell did that happen? But I taken a look at the replay, and it seems as if Leno is both wrong-footed and doesn't have eyes on it. And then before he knows it's in the goal.
Yeah. And I mean, Jack, this contest is killed by the fact that we concede a third in first half stoppage time.
Yeah.
You know, and we've made the changes by that point as well. And for me, that goal was the most frustrating in the night, because 2-0, you've made three changes. Fulham have got the ability to get back into this game, I think, at 2-0. And look, with the goal that Tosin scored, there could have been a real contest, but that is pretty criminal.
Yeah, it's hard because it's a good goal. I mean, it's well worked, but equally, it's also just a couple of give and goes. And, you know, sometimes that moves teams around. I think what was frustrating about that goal is that Fulham seemed to have found some control and a bit of calmness after the substitutions, and it obviously jolted everyone awake a little bit. So to concede like that is incredibly frustrating at that moment, because I think if you'd offered Forest 2-0, blow the whistle at halftime at 45 with the way that Fulham had started to find some groove, they would have probably taken it.
Yeah.
And actually I was like, no, play it out. And then we concede that. And it's like, it's such a hammer blow. It changes almost everything. So yeah, I mean, it's one of those. It's a well-worked goal. It's a little bit loose in a defensive sense. There's just, you know, when you find players like that, I just think that Morgan Gibbs-White had way too much time to begin with. And it goes back all the way to that Polina point, that as soon as Gibbs-White started running the game, you ask your best defensive central midfielder to sit in there and stop him running the game. That's what Polina should be doing in that exact moment. And the amount of time he has to execute that one, that give and go with Danilo, is slightly criminal as far as I'm concerned.
George, we did really make a fight of it in the second half. I mean, there was no way it could be any worse, really, than the first half. Tosin scores a header. I mean, he didn't have the best night, and I'm not sure scoring a goal from a corner was the biggest reprieve. I mean, we got a lot of corners in that second half and caused Forest a nightmare with those set pieces. Kenny Tete hit the bar, and it could have gone anywhere. Had that been 3-2, I think you're looking at a pretty exciting end to the game. So Fulham made a fist of it, but you know, you can't start playing at 3-0 and be like, oh, good work, lads.
Yeah, Tosin also forced a very, very good save.
From Sells.
Which I think was
outrageous.
Really, really good save. And if that had gone in, then it would have been, game on. I think we came out in the second half and did give them a really good show. The game was so open at that point as well, because Forest was still coming at us as well. So it turned into a basketball game up until about the sort of 65th minute, when Forest did eventually start to retreat and sit back. And then we found it really, really hard to get to have that same intensity. Dama Traore was having no luck against Olaina, who had him in his back pocket, quite frankly. He had a few good runs early on,
which I was surprised about, because I'd have thought those two, I mean, I saw like an absolute mismatch in the AFCON final against Simon Adingra. I thought like Adama Traore should have him on toast.
Simon Adingra is a technically better player than Adama Traore by some distance.
No, man. I get that, but still. Like,
there's levels
like,
to this
I
game.
I like Olaina, but like I really thought that like someone
brilliant.
Like...
That's second time in a couple of weeks. Mario Lemina ran the game against us, and now Olaina's pocketed two wingers in one
game. And Nico Williams didn't have a bad night.
And Nico Williams was right as well. Yeah, it was frustrating. It is just what it is, right?
Yeah, just adding to it, I think we came out and made a game of it, and there were a lot of Forest fans who were commenting on our quick take, saying that they were absolutely bricking it for large spells, just holding, wanting to hold on. But I will say that I think that we lacked real quality. You know, yes, we hit the bar. Yes, we forced some saves. Yes, we had a lot of shots. Very rarely was the keeper troubled apart from that toss and save. It was all just kind of pop shots and balls into the box that were getting cleared. And the same was for Nottingham Forest as well. They were, the shots that they came off were it turned into, it was very wet. It was very misty. It was very frantic. A lot of like nervous energy about the crowd. It was a much better showing, but ultimately it still, evidently in the scoreline wasn't good enough really.
Yeah. Jack, I mean, Fulham's form right now is absolutely wild. the games that we have played recently are just frankly ridiculous. So you had the 2-1 win over United. We then beat Brighton 3-0. We lost 2-1 at Wolves, beat Spurs 3-0, drew 3-3 at Sheffield United. And quite frankly, if things had gone slightly different, that could have been 4 or 5-1. And then we lost to Forest 3-1. Peter did a piece in The Athletic.
Please go and read it. I implore you. It is absolutely phenomenally
Give people
written.
A synopsis. Peter did a... What was the title? Give people a synopsis of Peter's piece.
Fulham, the most erratic team in the Premier League. I've got two segments that I've actually I copied and pasted so I could read out on the podcast. It's a really, really brilliant piece. And I'm not saying that because it's Peter. He's not actually here to receive these compliments. I really enjoyed it. I texted him this morning being like, that is a phenomenally well-written piece. He said, Fulham are impossible to pin down as a football team. They are a circle you cannot square, and you may have more joy nailing jelly to a wall. They swing violently from the sublime to the baffling. This is a team who have beaten Arsenal, Tottenham and Manchester United deservedly, but they've also given up 4 points to Burnley, conceded 3 at Sheffield United, and then repeated the trick within 45 minutes at Nottingham Forest. And, I mean, I think the crux of the piece comes in this paragraph. He says, last season, Fulham comfortably took points off sides below them in the table and could not beat the sides above them. Now, they're capable of taking points off sides above them, whilst inexplicably dropping points to those below them. Admittedly, that would suggest progress and regression at the same time. Schrodinger's Fulham. I thought it was sensational. I loved it. And
it's really silly, isn't it? Not the piece.
We're actually just generally dumb football team, aren't we? Like, I was like, what a life. What a life we live. We can come in here and wax lyrical about absolutely playing Spurs off the park. And then watch the 45 minutes that we've just seen. I mean, you know, the podcast is named thus for a reason, right? We're actually at that point. It's fine in some ways in that we have done enough already to make sure that this isn't going to be an issue. But it's kind of like all of the talk of discussing Europe and thinking, could we be outside, you know, and outside. We'd won these two games. We'd be knocking on the door in the way that Bournemouth are. Now, I'm not saying that Bournemouth are going to be a team in
More
Europe
knocking.
Next year.
We'd be literally in the European spots.
It's like, but there are spaces to in this year, and I know I said this last year, so maybe it will happen again, but in a year where Newcastle have fallen away a bit, West Ham don't look all that good, Chelsea are a mess, Manchester United are still even, you know, away from that conversation in a way that maybe you'd expect them to be. Brighton haven't been as consistent as they were last year. It feels like an opportunity. And it's one that I think at this point we've now passed up. Now watch when we go and beat Newcastle 5-0 at the weekend. But
yeah, like, get a result against Liverpool and City.
100%.
And then lose to Brentford and Luton.
It's the Robin Hood. Well, I did text halfway through last game. We were like, are we just 4D chessing trying to get Brentford relegated? Because, I mean, that would add a whole new layer of complexity to this idea. But it doesn't make any sense. We do actually, though, something that does make sense. We have a dreadful record against Nuno Espirito Santo.
Yes.
I think we've only beaten him once.
And that was being the promotion season.
Slavisa.
Yeah, 2-0. Yeah,
that's the only time we've beaten a Nuno side. So it's clearly not something that's new to this Forest side. He seems to have Fulham's number over a variety of different managers. But just something I thought was worth bearing in mind. But, I mean, look, we're baffling. One player, though, I did want to talk about was Andreas Pereira.
Good.
Who I actually thought had an excellent game.
Yes.
And when he came off in the second half.
Why take him off?
I don't know. And I actually thought maybe the move was to bring Bobby on for Kenny Tete at that point. Because
great right back.
Well, it was more that kind of like, if we lose 4-1 or we lose 3-1,
yeah,
it's kind of the same, isn't it? We're not here on a real scrap for goal difference or trying to make sure those things happen. So it felt like an opportunity to just go for it. But taking him off, I think we lost all cohesion in our attacks. I thought his corners were mostly excellent. Obviously, yeah. You know, we scored from one, we hit the bar from another. There was a couple of different elements that we tried that I thought worked really well. He was unlucky. I thought that his cross for Muniz in the first half was a really smart cross as well. Everything good about Fulham in the first half, and there wasn't much, admittedly, was Andreas. And I know he's frustrating, and I know that occasionally he just pings long shots into the crowd, and he does have a knack for doing that in really frustrating moments when Fulham actually look like we're creating something around the box. But he makes things happen, and yesterday I thought he was one of the very few bright spots in that Fulham team.
Yeah, it's frustrating almost that like Silva insists on starting him when sometimes you're not sure he should be started. But then when he is playing well, then he gets pulled off every game in the bloody 70th minute. Like, we're building something here. Andreas Pereira's off. Oh, now we're not building anything anymore. I was completely baffled by it. But maybe Marco by that point was like, I don't think we're winning
done,
here.
Game's done. Let's get so it.
One eye on Newcastle.
Well,
on,
JP came off as well, right? So, same thing.
Yeah. Well, look, not one to write home about. Hopefully, on Saturday, Fulham can correct a few things against Newcastle United. We'll take a break here and preview that game next. Part two of the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy here with Jack and Coops. Thank you to Green King Sport for sponsoring the Thursday Club this season. Head to your local Green King Sport pub to watch any televised action. There's lots of games this weekend on the box, not Fulham, of course, but obviously there's Man United Liverpool on Sunday. There's Spurs Forest, 6 p.m. on Sunday, which is a bit of a rogue.
There's been a lot of weird times of football matches recently, haven't there?
Not really sure why that's a 6 p.m. kickoff, but anyway, United Liverpool's at 3:30 on Sunday if you want to watch that. Brighton versus Arsenal, the Saturday tea time, so maybe if you want to find your local Green King Sport pub after the Fulham game. Also, on Thursday, there's Liverpool, Sheffield United, Chelsea, Man United on TNT Sports. So lots of great sport on the box. Head to your local Green King Sport pub. And if you download the Green King Sport app, you can get 10% off your drinks during any televised match.
It's all about the continent this weekend, Sammy, outside of Fulham. Okay. Roma Lazio in the Derby della Capitale in Rome, which is pretty cool. Saturday, 5 p.m, I think.
Yeah.
And then it's the Copa del Rey final. One of Athletic Club and Mallorca are going to win the title for the first time since 2003, I think, for Mallorca in 1984 Athletic Club. So that's what I'm going to be watching.
Is it Real Mallorca?
RCD Mallorca, yeah.
Okay, yeah. One of the few. I don't actually know the potted history of why certain clubs get the Real title. I see.
It's because they got a blessing, if you will, or a kind of some sort of thing from the Spanish royal family.
Okay.
It just means royal. There you go.
Be quite good if they did that in England.
Royal Fulham.
It would suit us.
I might have to leave. But
well, yes. You might have to switch allegiances. Right, let's look ahead to Newcastle on Saturday. Another kind of batshit club, actually. Two batshit clubs up against each other on Saturday. Who knows what on earth will happen?
Getting that Chalobah back in here.
I mean, their recent form, pretty good at home, pretty bad away. Should suit us. But at the same time, I've got no idea what to make of Fulham right now. I mean, they've had an interesting couple of weeks. Obviously, won that mad game against West Ham, 4-3, came back from 3-1 down. On Tuesday night, they had a pretty disappointing result against Everton, drew 1-1.
They should have been 4-0 up.
Oh, God, they should have absolutely battered them. But Everton, you know, dug in, got a penalty, scored it. I honestly, Jack, don't know what to make of it, but I feel like if I could cherry pick a team in the league that I would like to play this weekend, I'd say Newcastle would be my top five or six in order to get us back to some sort of form at home at Craven Cottage.
Yeah, they're above us in the table, so that bodes well,
yes,
right?
That's
so
good.
We only beat teams above us in the table. They have an absolute shed load of players injured or absent for various reasons, which is nice. Lewis Miley's out, Nick Pope's out, Kieran Trippier's been confirmed. He won't play by Eddie Howe today. Tino Livramento's out, so I'm not no idea what they're going to do at right and left back. Joel Linton's out, Callum Wilson's out, Jamal Lascelles is out for the season, Matt Target's out for the season, Miguel Almiron's out, Sven Botman's out, and obviously Sandro Tonali is not allowed to play football at the moment. So, I mean, yeah, if you were going to pick a moment to play Newcastle, it feels like a good one, which is never that good a sign. I kind of want them to be at full strength, gunning for the European positions. That seems to be the only time that we turn it on. I think that there has to be a reaction, right? That's, I think, what we come to now, because we've had, I think it's fair to say, two bad performances in a row. And whilst there was a little bit of catharsis at the end of the Sheffield United game, and you said it earlier, it was a bit papering over the cracks. So it needs a response. And, you know, Tom Cairney's saying after the game that we need to find solutions, we need to find a response. I think we will see some quite interesting changes from Marco Silva here. I wouldn't be surprised at all, just out of interest, that at least two, maybe all three, of the players who were subbed after 30 minutes start this game to try and force a reaction out of those players to be like, go on then, show me. And I think it could be a very, very interesting one to see how that develops. But, I mean, you said it. It's so hard to call what Fulham's going to show up. So how do you predict it? Newcastle have players who can hurt you. Obviously, Alex Isak's in wonderful form. There are Anthony Gordon comes back from suspension here. We've just been absolutely torched down the left wing and through the middle in that game. Alex Isak and Anthony Gordon running at our right back slash right centre back doesn't fill me with loads of confidence. Equally, I think we can score against this Newcastle side. And I think that there will be a Fulham response. As, you know, Guy Ritchie once said, every action has a reaction. There has to be.
One thing I will say, Jack, that you failed to mention is our record against Newcastle.
Oh, it's absolutely dreadful, yeah. It's just 100%, diabolical. That's what I mean. Throw it all out the window. Like, nothing makes sense this season, so we'll probably win 5-0.
Also, on the injury point, they were in a pretty similar state when we played them at St James's. Do you remember Joe Linton went off after about 20 minutes?
I think we would have won that game without him and had decided to bum someone in the face.
Yeah, that was perhaps a bit of a spanner in the
works.
There's
been asterisks about both Newcastle games as well, because I think, as you say, I think the Raul Jimenez red card I genuinely think we were going to win that game up at St James's Park, or at least put in a very good performance in that game. Plus, St James's Park, a tough place to go. And then the FA Cup game.
This is the world's biggest shrug, isn't it?
Well, it was just a bit. It was a contentious game for all sorts of reasons off the pitch. And also, we just lost to Liverpool. We'd had like 3 days rest. We were knackered. We had no players. And we actually put in a half all right
performance
and probably should have got something more out of it. I mean, George, you're right, though, on our record against Newcastle. I mean, we did play them, like, it seemed to be for quite a while, every season, last game of the season, lost 4-0. They then came to Craven Cottage and won 4-0 last year as well. It might be 4-1, actually. I think Bobby Decker over-read scored a consolation, if I'm not mistaken.
The Nat Chalobah game.
Yeah.
That's the Nat Chalobah game. Yeah, it's about time we got a win against Newcastle, George.
Yeah, we're due one. I think approach it positively. Hopefully we get a big reaction from the team. As Jack pointed out, Newcastle are plagued with injuries. But I don't know, I just never, ever... when was the last time we got a decent result against them?
Probably up at St James's Park.
I remember we had
Sessegnon.
Yeah, that was when
TC scored a
Tim Ream took the penalty.
Oh yeah, that was actually so mean.
And also, I seem to remember we had a really crazy like 5-3 against them 1 year, didn't we? At the Craven Cottage.
Matt Smith's header 1-0 at the Cottage.
Yeah, first game. First of game. Of
the we're peering into the corridors of time.
Well, the weird thing was is that for me, like certainly when I was like kind of a teenager, that kind of like maybe 2005 to 2012 period, Newcastle was one of the bankers. Newcastle at home saved our season on numerous occasions where Fulham would be in a terrible run of form and we'd be like, don't worry, lads, it's Newcastle, 2-1 Fulham, Brian McBride will score, Ida Helgeson will get another. Like, it felt like it was our kind of gimme game for so many years. And then, yeah, it's only in recent years where they started coming to Craven Cottage. It's a bit like when Everton broke the promise back when we always used to win at Craven Cottage. They always used to win at Goodison Park. And then they started coming to Craven Cottage and winning. It was like, lads, we had an agreement here.
Well, now we can't lose at Goodison Park. So
yeah,
that's all good.
Yeah, we've kind of had our own
balance
there.
Restored. Didn't Dempsey get a hat-trick against Newcastle? Didn't he? That was a good day.
I mean, Jack, in terms of lineup then, what's your prediction?
What's my prediction, or what would I do?
What would you do, actually, is more interesting.
I've seen some calls for Marek Rodak to be given the shirt, which feels a bit mad. So I'm not gonna give them any time.
Who's saying that?
There's a bit of chat about Bern Leno and some of the goals he's been conceding, and the fact that there has been a bit of chat that he needs some pressure on him because the performances have dropped off. I think there is maybe something to be said for the performances dropping off. I don't think there's anything to be said for dropping him from the team. So that's not going to happen. Leno will start and goal. I think I'd be tempted to bring Issa Diop back in.
Really?
I think Tosin's last 32 performances have been dreadful. And whilst, like, obviously Tim Ream is the obvious person, I think Calvin Bassey should probably continue at left centre back.
Yeah, you don't bring it away. Unless you put Ream on the right, but again, it's
I don't like it. So therefore, the only alternative option here is Diop. So I assume that that's the one that you look for. So I'm going to say Diop and Bassey, I might go for, just to kind of remind those. And also bear in mind, you know, the contract talks are going on. There's a lot going on off the pitch at the moment. It just hasn't felt quite right in the last two games there. So, I mean, maybe there's just something to be said for that. I think Castagne comes back in at right back. I think when it goes to left back, Anthony Robinson is absolutely locked on, solid. That's not going to change. In the middle, I didn't think TC was very good last night.
No, nor did I.
But I think I would play him. I just think a little bit of, you know, just to give a sense of, right, put the armband back on Tom Kenny. We're at home. Let's try and control the game from the outset. Let's not try and, you know, let things slip away from us. I go with Tom Kenny and Polina. Pereira in the middle. I think I'd go Iwobi on the right and Willian on the left. And then Mooney's up top.
Okay. Would you not go with, like, because you said you thought he might bring a few of the three amigos that came on, like,
three musketeers. I know I've only just put one of them in Iwobi, but I then, sort of questioning, Pereira was brilliant. Willian, I thought, was bright when he came on, which only really leaves one spot in there, unless you play Iwobi deeper next to Polina, which feels risky.
What about Adama?
No, I don't think I'd start Adama. Like, as in, Adama didn't do very much. He hit the post, obviously. But
that was like, that broke land speed records, that shot.
Like, I didn't think he was actually very good when he came on. Like, I understand why Marco made the change, but as in, Adama didn't do loads. He didn't do loads with the ball. And I think as an impact weapon, he offers more to this team against tired legs than he does from the start.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, fair enough. George, anyone that you particularly want to see either on or not on the pitch? What do you think about, you know, switching out Tosin? I wouldn't. I feel like Tosin has had a bad few games and, you know, wonder if it's a little bit of a reality check with him. Like, yes, you're really good, Tosin, but, like, you can't let your standards drop. But
if anyone else had two bad games, we'd be asking for someone else.
If
Lukic has had two bad games post Spurs, and I think Polina
can have as many bad games. Leno can have lots of bad games.
Yeah, yeah. But I think those people are cornerstones of the side.
Well, I think Tosin's a cornerstone of the side.
Okay, well, that makes one of us.
I would argue that Tosin's performance yesterday was made to look worse because of the lack of cover that he had.
Yeah, I would have.
Polina was up the field.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, I don't know. I wouldn't personally sub him out. I'd give him Mbassi. I think that overall it's been a net positive having those two as a partnership. So I would keep it the same, but I would definitely want Zhao to be sat deeper against Newcastle. The thing that I think will be really interesting to see is whether Muniz plays, because there's been a bit of talk about him having sustained a sort of ankle swelling and ankle injury, which put him as a doubt for the Sheffield United game. And then obviously it was such a quick turnaround for the Forest game on Tuesday, and he really didn't look at it. He didn't look as involved. And I do wonder whether he's just holding a slight knock. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see Raul come back in, but more of a kind of injury caution rather than a, you know, dropping as it were.
Breuer? Are we ever going to see Armando Breuer again? Yeah, the weirdest signing of all time.
So peak to be him right now.
Yeah,
it?
I feel incredibly sorry for him. He hasn't really done anything.
He hasn't done anything wrong.
He's just come into the side when Rodrigo Muniz has turned into prime R9. There's not much about that.
Interestingly, do you see reports that supposedly we tried and failed to sign him on a permanent in August, the summer?
I'm not surprised by that either. We've had an eye on Breuer for a long time.
I mean, arguably, we no longer care when he's with us.
Well, do you reckon we're just trying to drive his? I think I've said this before. We're trying to drive his value into the dirt so we can buy him for like $4 million in the summer.
Underhand tactics.
Yeah, yeah, it's insider trading, I think.
Yeah. Just back on defence. One thing that just suddenly came to mind: have Bassey and Diop had much of a chance to play together? I'd have said that was one of the few combinations we haven't seen. Really,
never seen loads of it. No.
So that's the only thing is. Do you try? Well,
you know, both of them are going to be here next year.
Yes. If Tosin's contract's still not going, I've seen calls for that where you're saying, well, if Tosin's not going to sign, and no one really knows what the situation is there, but if you're going to need to future plan, now's the time to bed in Bassey and Diop. And we haven't seen that. And you do wonder, like, Diop's got his limitations, but he's also got his advantages. I wonder if maybe Bassey's quite a good foil to cover some of Diop. You know, he can be a little bit erratic at times, but he's also a Rolls Royce of a defender on his day.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I could see as an advantage of, like, let's see how it goes.
Give it a whirl. I don't know if starting it against Alexander Isak, probably the most informed striker in the league.
It does feel quite a step up from Diop, though, from him not being in the squad to starting out of nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that there is an element of that. It's just like someone has to drop off the bench, and you have options in terms of Tim Ream is, you know, elder statesman. If someone needs to come in and step in and calm things down, he feels like the more obvious option. Equally, Diop can play left and right centre back. So, you know, maybe he is the more fluid member of this. I don't know. I think that's a bit of an unfortunate coincidence. It goes back to what we were talking about with injuries earlier. So I don't think you're going to read too much into that bit in particular, I think.
Yeah. All right. We'll take a break there. Afterwards, we're getting some of your emails. Part three of the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy here with Jack and George. George mentioned it on Sunday's podcast, but tickets for our latest Fulhamish live show at the Half Moon Putney are on sale now. So straight after the Crystal Palace game, we're going to be recording a live podcast from the Half Moon. We've done this a few times now. It's a really, really fun evening. Well, we think so anyway. We'll let you be the judges of that once you've been. The legendary journalist, Paddy Barclay, is going to be our special guest on stage, plus loads of your Fulhamish favourites. We're going to be discussing the game. We'll be doing a special recording of This'll Catch On. It's always just a lot of fun. So if you want to come down, grab your tickets now. Link in the description of this podcast. You can also head to fulhamish.co.uk and there is a link on the website there too. But yeah, link in the description. Grab your tickets. We'd love to see you there straight after the Palace game for Fulhamish Live at the Half Moon. Let's get into some of your questions. We'll also be doing that at the live show. You can ask your questions live to the podcast. We'll pass a microphone around the room. But for now, we're doing emails. Justin Rains with the first one here, titled The Let Off. Says, hey, y'all, long time listener, many times emailer.
Very good.
Yeah. We clearly came into the Blades match at half pace, expecting to walk through with ease. Tosin's mistake for the first is a classic Fulhamish let-off against a lesser side. We clearly need to rid those from our game to take the next step. How do we go about doing that? Where does the blame lie?
Concentrate, I suppose. I think it feeds back into everything we were saying, right? Like, tactically, I think we've been off it for the last couple of games, and it just does feel like we allowed opposition Marco will have said to the players before both of those games and looked at the obvious threats that they carry, and yet we've been undone by those obvious threats. And that, I imagine for him, he must be pulling his hair out, because it's not like Forest have opened us up by doing something completely different that Fulham weren't prepared for. He would have looked at that team and been like, right, they're going to attack down either flank. They're going to try and bring those players into the game through using Wood and Gibbs-White as a combination, knockdowns from the middle that allow the wingers to get wide. And those were the things that tore us apart. You know, those combinations, they would have said, if you let Morgan Gibbs-White run this game, he will create and score. And that's exactly what he did. And we had no answer to it. And that's what's frustrating about it. So concentrate might seem like a silly answer or a kind of facetious answer. But it's not really. It's not, you know, if you get out undone by a team who are playing brilliantly or by a brilliant goal or all of these things, you can accept it, right? You go, okay, fine. If Alex Isak turns one on at the weekend, one of the best strikers in the division, and he bangs in a hat trick that you just absolutely can do nothing about, sometimes you have to stand and be like, got beaten by a better player. But you can't let them have the spaces to make those things happen. And I think that it is a case of actually just almost getting heads back in the game with this one. It just hasn't been good enough in terms of getting those of switching on in the last two games.
I mean I'm kind of wincing as I'm saying this, but I question whether it's a I would ask whether it's a question of motivation, maybe, because obviously we don't have anything really to play for anymore. And it's kind of shown in the performances and those lapses of concentration. And I just question whether a slight shift in mentality with this Fulham side, and can we sort of start thinking about it, right, we're now putting in the yards in preparation for next year. Like, if you want to be part of this squad, if you want to be a Fulham player, this is when you really need to start putting your shift in. But it's obviously, it's not as immediate. It's a bit more long-term payoff. But it's like we've been on the beach these last few games. So I would argue if there's anything that, I'm not a football manager, I'm not Marco Silva, yeah, but just bring that bit of urgency and a bit of, whether it be playing for the fans or playing for their places, playing for their, want to be putting in a good claim to be playing for their countries in the tournaments in the summer. We just need that kick up the arse somehow. And I don't know how you deliver that, but I trust Marco should be able to find a way.
I didn't do the podcast post Sheffield United, but I did do Cam Ramsey's positives and negatives. And I wrote in that saying that I felt like our first half against Sheffield United, it wasn't arrogant, but also it was passive, just as if like we can just play our football and we'll be able to eventually break down the Sheffield United. And there was a few moments that, and the one that stood out, and I don't want to single him out because I think it was more, it showed the problem that I think ran through the whole team. It was just a visible example of it. Andreas Pereira did this random trick pass in the first half where he was under no pressure at all. The kind of thing that like someone might just come and wipe you out for, because it was just a little bit.
It's the sort of thing that if Brian Clough was managing, he would have taken them off immediately.
Yeah, it was a little bit borderline disrespectful. I mean, look, he had the ball and he was no one near him and he just did a little bit of a trick. But to me, that's not the sign of a team that was desperate to go out and...
I always hesitate to suggest that players having fun with it is a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a bit totally Pulis mentality.
I get that. But like, also, is that a team going? Is that a team going for hell for leather? We've got to win at all costs and absolutely like break down the way that we were.
If someone did a rainbow flick over their head and scored a bicycle kick, you'd be like, "That's class," even though it's obviously a bit silly. Like,
well, if that's the best way to score.
Well, like, as in, I think that we sometimes hesitate to say joy at, like, Andreas has just got back in the Brazil squad.
No,
he's a samba footballer having some fun times.
I'm trying to say that was just an example of the team's attitude, I feel like. It wasn't really like, do one trick pass and everything's gone wrong. I mean, the fans enjoyed it at the time and everyone went and started doing ole when it was 0-0 in 25 minutes against Sheffield United and the fans are doing...
We always concede when we do that.
Well, Anthony Robinson miscontrolled it and it went out for a throw-in after it happened. We all got what we deserved. And as I say, I'm trying not to single out Pereira here. I felt like that was emblematic of the whole team.
No, I like part of me almost wants, this is going to sound ridiculous, part of me wants more of that. I'm a bit like, all right, what I don't want, I don't think that you can equate that to not caring. I actually want Fulham to go out at the weekend and be like, go and have fun. Go and enjoy it.
Express
but,
yourselves.
No, but like, yeah, it is a bit that, isn't it? Yeah. It's a bit Mike Bassett. But like, I do kind of think that actually it feels a bit like they're stuck between stations at the moment. It's a bit like, okay, we've got to go through the motions. We've got to do the things that we're told that, you know, we'll win games. But actually, there's no pressure on us. So therefore, we're not as motivated to do those things as we might be if we were in a race for survival, promotion, Europe, whatever.
But we should be motivated.
Go and have a good time. Go and enjoy yourselves. Make some stuff happen. Score more scissor kicks. Like, that's kind of what I want from it.
I think we should be motivated. You look at like how much a Premier League place is worth. Europe's potentially on the line there. There's plenty to be motivated about. Yes, I get it. Look, we came up against Nottingham Forest last night and it was a difficult atmosphere and they didn't just want it, they absolutely needed it and were going to die for it last night. And yeah, maybe that's hard to get players
probably,
to that level.
You're looking at Sheffield United as well, and you know, every point is sacred right now, right?
Yeah, the way they celebrated those goals was just pure. Also, I think for themselves, as well, like, even if they know that they're probably going down, I think almost for them to prove that, like, we are actually all right at football here and everyone's written us off and everyone
thinks
we're shit.
Yeah, and there's a lot of youngsters
shit
in there. Oli Arblaster played, like all sorts of those kind of things.
Well, also, I think Brereton Diaz is there to prove a point that he's a Premier League player. So he particularly enjoyed those celebrations because I think it means a lot to him personally.
Yeah, I buy that.
I'm not here trying to like.
Sammy hates fun.
Yeah.
That's the three-word review for today's podcast.
Sammy's rant is perfectly encapsulated by that Neil Warnock quote where he goes, by all means, enjoy it, but enjoy it by being fucking disciplined.
That's me in a nutshell. This next email from Georgie Brooke is titled Strikers. Finest Fulhamish folk, greetings once again from the other side of the planet. Whether Muniz continues his goal again trajectory or not, spoiler alert, he didn't, but...
Hey, just needs two at the weekend. Yeah. We're okay again.
Georgie says, next season we need a minimum of two strong strikers vying for the one in our four something happens with and without the ball one setup.
I may need you to unpack that one.
No, it's just like Fulham player four, something happens one.
Right, got you.
Yeah. That took me a little while. I've read that word for word, but I was a bit confused. This close season, in my opinion, is going to see a striker merry-go-round, the likes of which has not been seen in many a long year. Big names will both fill and leave big holes this summer. Osimhen, Gyökeres, Tony, Isak, Werner, and Nketiah.
Nowhere, by the way. Gyökeres is staying at Sporting. He's as happy as he's ever been, and they want £100 million for him. And if anyone pays £100 million for Gyökeres, they're kidding themselves. Great player. £50 million player. You double pay for him, you've only got yourselves to blame.
Could be the difference. Be warned!
Just a heads up. Someone pays £100 million for Gyökeres, they are nuts. And I love, a big fan, really enjoying what he's doing at Sporting, but have a phenomenal season. He's getting nowhere.
If you're Arsenal, and he could be the difference between you fighting for the league and winning it comfortably.
No chance. Osimhen might be. Gyökeres ain't.
All right. Anyway, he's talked about a big striker merry-go-round. With all of this going on, does this make it easier or harder for Fulham in the market? For me, there is a very interesting striker that may well go under the radar, whether Forest go down or not, they have to sell. And Wanyi is a battler like Muniz. He also knows how to turn a touch into a shot while the defender is still pondering life. Is this someone who should be on our shopping list? Obviously, Georgie wrote this before he realised we'd gift 3 points to Forest and probably their Premier League safety. But, suggestion.
If they went down, that would be a very, very good signing.
But I guess this goes back to, I think we're still going to need a little bit more time to work out whether we need a starting striker in the market or whether we need someone to... add some squad depth behind Muniz, because there's two different strikers there.
Yeah. Go and sign Ben Brereton-Diaz. Go and sign Cameron Archer.
We've been talking about Brereton-Diaz for
20 years. It's been like... 109 years.
Yeah, he is the modern Jason Kumas.
Who's there? I remember Dwight Gayle as well. We always used to get links.
Oh, we might sign Dwight Gayle this summer. I think it might be time. Yeah. Taking the assistant manager.
Yeah, I think we just basically need more time on Muniz to work out whether he's absolutely solidly, you stick all your eggs in the Rodrigo Muniz basket, or if you need proper competition for Muniz, whether it's a Raul or whether it's, as you say, signing what I would call a marquee striker, someone that's going to come in and absolutely expect to start.
You also have to think about Stansfield, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But Stansfield's not going to play centre-forward most likely if he's in the squad.
I don't think so, but it is worth bearing in mind that Fulham not only have to make a decision on the future and where we are on Rodrigo Muniz, but also on where Jay Stansfield's future lies. And if it's like another loan, if it's a loan from going at the bottom half of the championship to the top half of the championship, what that looks like for him next season, or if he's ready to be reintegrated into this Fulham squad as part of the first team. And if he is, where's he going to play? There's a lot of questions to answer, I think, before we can get an answer on what Fulham's strategy here looks like.
Correct. He scored for Birmingham.
He had big goal.
Big goal for them recently. He's looking very sharp.
One, he's got 10 now.
Just on the topic of Muniz, there was another element of his game which I noticed last night. As I said earlier, he didn't have a particularly strong game. However, his athleticism and his ability to get on the end of headers, but also just to generate power off a header where there's not necessarily that zip on the cross, really stood out to me yesterday. They did it on two or three occasions where he was, granted, they weren't always troubling the goalie, they weren't always on target, but to get high up with an impressive leap and then put power on a header on a cross where there's not that power is a real skill. Mm-hmm. And he showed that yesterday, and it certainly raised my eyebrows. I thought it was something of note. But, and just loop back to the original question, I think that we need to sign somebody who is... I mean, are we going to sign a marquee striker, the elusive Mitrovic replacement that we were kind of pining for. I think it's highly unlikely that we will, because I can't see Fulham shelling out 50, 60 million on a striker this year for a big name that we all know and are excited about. I really can't. I think it will be somebody who's perhaps got slightly more pedigree than Moon is, who will be challenging him for the place. That would be where my prediction lies.
Ben Brereton Diaz. This one from Hammersmith End. That's all I have name-wise here.
Or just like The Stand?
Yes.
Like The Stand has sent us an email?
Yes.
Wicked.
I'd love to get one from the Putney End next week. Hammersmith then says, I can't be the only person to notice the completely different tones between the Chelsea Supporters Trust and the Fulham Supporters Trust when it comes to their approach to communicating with their respective clubs. The recent Chelsea statement was basically threatening the board with toxic protests if a myriad of issues aren't addressed, compared to our Fulham Supporters Trust, which asks the board for change whilst condemning things as harmless as banners. Obviously, we have very different fan bases, thankfully, but with McIntosh basically telling the FST to their face that they will be gradually phased out in favour of the club-selected fan advisory board, surely there has to be an acceptance that they have massively failed their paying membership. It also presents an opportunity for a new approach with essentially nothing to lose now. I still see the value of the FST and will continue to support it financially, but we should take a leaf from Chelsea fans on this one and be more confident and vocal. Maybe it's melodramatic, but it feels Fulham is at a crossroads, and if we continue down this path, we will lose the community and soul of the club. Something you can sell, but not something you can buy back. And that's from H5. So we've got a specific part of the Stand now sending us the email. Look, jokes aside about the kind of anonymity of whoever sent us that, I wouldn't quite say as strongly as they've massively failed their paying membership, but I do agree, Jack, that there's not much to be lost now by being far more vocal, especially now the club have made their position pretty bloody clear.
Yeah, I mean, softly, softly, catchy monkey has not worked, right? That we've come to that point where, look, I think it's important to understand the dynamics of that relationship at Chelsea before you start comparing them. There's a lot going on with that statement. And then, very weirdly, the Chelsea Fan Advisory Board, who I think are semi-selected, I'm not quite sure the exact details,
I
believe they're semi-selected, came out with a kind of anti-statement to basically say that the Chelsea Supporters Trust statement was wrong. And then the person who's the head of the Chelsea Supporters Trust is signed on both statements. So I have no idea what's going on at Chelsea, but it all feels incredibly weird. I did think that letter was at times a little bit weird in some ways. I think they had some serious points about being like, but them being like, we will continue to chant toxic things about the ownership is a pretty odd, an odd threat to make.
I didn't love every element.
I didn't like the tone of it, but I did like the directness with which they felt that they could speak. And I think we do miss that at the FST 100%. And look, you'd have to speak to people more involved than I am, or, you know, involved in the FST and the way it runs, to understand truly why that is. But from my perspective, and from someone who spends a lot of time looking at the cultures of clubs around the world, it is only the clubs who have a respectful and working relationship between the club and the fan base. And that involves difficult conversations sometimes. That isn't just, you will do what we tell you, that have these successful abilities to continue to foster and bond that relationship. It just seems to me that Fulham have zero interest in it. And I'm with you in terms of, if the bridges are burned, then you have to find another element. You have to find another way of showing that people care. Jakub came on the other week and was like, the more people that are in the FST, the more people they can go to the club with and be like, look, these people are speaking. But I think that the time has come for more direct action. Yeah, I completely agree with that.
Yeah, I think part of me with the Chelsea Supporters Trust statement, it read slightly, and look, maybe this is an unfair criticism, it read slightly of them, I don't really, it read slightly that they were miserable because they're crap on the pitch.
Yeah. I agree. It was like, this is unacceptable. Like, well, what is? The performances, the tickets, like, they didn't feel like there was an actual line of attack. It just felt like, it felt like someone had written that email at 2 a.m. after 8 pints. That's what I can say about it. Don't get me wrong. I think that there are parts about it that I'm like, it's good that they're bringing these issues to light. But it felt like someone was like, right, I've had enough. And yeah. just decided to write it and just like spill out all their inner emotions without any sort of like sense of control over what they were actually complaining about. And I think that's never that good an idea.
Yeah. And that's the thing for me is actually what we're angry about. Fulham fans are angry despite on the pitch it being probably one of the best it's ever been.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
Like this isn't really about on the pitch actions. Yes, we can be upset about on the pitch and there will be times and
I'm upset about Tuesday's result.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean that that's the reason that I'm upset with Fulham right now.
Yeah, and I don't really need the supporters' trust either to probably likely like
they don't need to tell me that I'm angry about that.
Yeah,
that's fine. They did. I'm all for being
more
other things.
Yeah, I think there's a halfway house of being happy for them to be more vocal, like Chelsea. And I see the Leeds supporters' trust always being extremely vocal.
Yeah,
always I feel like standing up for the fans absolutely first and foremost, and not worrying about the relationship with the club.
Spirit of Shankly. You know, you look at the fan groups in Liverpool, they're brilliant at this. The protests, they walked out, tickets came down. They're like, it happened. We've seen it happen in real time in the last few years at a club where arguably you'd suggest that actually fans matter less because there's so many people coming through to watch Liverpool every single week. They oversell over and over and over again in terms of they would be able to, you know, pack out Anfield many times over. If they can do it with that kind of background, there is no reason we shouldn't be able to with a fan base or a club that relies far more on a consistent fan base right now than another.
Yeah. We didn't sell out the away end last night, by the way, Alistair McIntosh, just in case you think we have enough fans already.
Didn't even come close. And the Nottingham Forest fans were very quick to point that out as well.
Yeah, and this is not a slight on anyone didn't go. I didn't go. It's because we don't have enough fans. Literally, there isn't a big enough core sports base to fill out away allocations on a regular basis. You can't just count on the same 2,000 or 3,000 people being able to go to every single flipping game when it's as expensive as it is and people have lives.
And there's a cost of living crisis.
Yeah.
Just playing devil's advocate, Sammy, would that point still be valid given that obviously away tickets are £30 across the board?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, because this isn't about the cost of going to which wasn't too cheap, trains and all of that, but it's...
Yeah, you still have to pay for travel.
It's the fact that out of a certain, let's say there's 40,000 Fulham fans...
Yeah, that's probably about right. For
yeah, how many... Only a certain amount is going to have the time, money, desire to go to Nottingham on a Tuesday night. The aim should be to grow that core 40,000 to 60,000. Then you'll probably sell out your away allocations and take advantage of the £30. That's the whole point. This is what Fulham should be doing. We need to go from 40,000 to 60,000. We'll always sell out games. We'll always bring good numbers to away supporters. But clearly our current strategy is, in my opinion, not doing very much to grow that from 40 to 60 or whatever.
The current strategy is to bolster that 40,000 with 5,000 people that come through London on a regular, you know, on an irregular basis.
Yeah.
5,000 people who are in town for the weekend. That doesn't work in terms of, one, if, as we've said before, if things go wrong and Fulham are in the Championship, people are not going to find it as attractive a destination with, what, 17 London clubs?
Yeah.
Is there? So... that, and then two, those people are not going to be going to Nottingham on a Tuesday night. They just never will be. So that growth of a core support is hugely important for all of the above.
Yeah. And on a similar topic, we got this email, which I thought was really, really interesting. And specifically, the title is Please Keep Anonymous Confession. So,
says... Fesshole.
Yeah, this is the Fulhamish Fesshole. He says, hello, Fulhamish. I know this will get me into trouble. I know this will lead me to receiving hatred from some quarters of the fan base. I am not trying to defend my actions in any way. And if I were to get caught by the club one day, I would have no choice but to accept my wrongdoings. However, there is no point hiding what I and other season ticket holders have done. We do resell tickets. They say, me and my family have been going to Fulham for more than a decade. Next year, it's going to cost me more than £3,000 to pay for everyone. We aren't the biggest of clubs, so fans of the opposition will inevitably get hold of tickets whether we like it or not. I can't afford to take my family to the cottage every week if I don't do this otherwise. I would rather us four be in our seats every week rather than those tickets being snapped up by the opposition supporters anyway. I'm not doing this out of greed. I've only started doing this because going to Fulham is simply unaffordable now otherwise, and this is actually the model that the Khans would want if it wasn't for UK laws. I'm well versed in how ticketing works in the NFL, and everything is sold on resale to the highest payer, and it is really common for families in the US to subsidize the cost of their massively priced season tickets by selling a portion of their games off for resale. I recall comments at the start of the 22-23 season when questioned about the £150 tickets in the Riverside. Shad pretty much accepted that most of these seats would be bought by touts to sell on, because whenever he'd come to games, he'd see different tourists in the Riverside every week, so the club might as well get their cut from tout sales by charging more. Again, I accept what I'm doing is not what people will want to hear, but what Fulham is doing to us means my only other option is to most likely have four less supporters at the ground every week, because I need to prioritise keeping a roof over the head of my family. I am not a professional ticket tout, just a long-time desperate fan, hoping to keep the family tradition alive. If the club offered an affordable alternative so I didn't have to go down this route, I would take it in a heartbeat.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think that we need to add anything, do we?
No.
Like, it speaks for itself. But am I driving loyal old school fans away by pricing them out? We've been saying this for, what, how many years? This is the sad reality of the situation.
Yeah, no, completely. I mean, as you say, I for what it's worth, like, I think there is a difference between subsidizing the cost of your season ticket and just out and out being a tout.
Yeah,
I think there's a massive
There's one thing doing this, and there's another thing, buying a season ticket and putting on SeatGeek every weekend, right? That's obviously not.
Well,
that might be, for
what we know, that might be exactly what this person's doing.
No, but not every weekend. That's the point, right?
Yeah.
This is the whole, this scenario is so that they can go to games.
Yeah.
It's sad. It makes me upset.
It makes me upset as well, because, like, ultimately, if you do get offered £250 a ticket, and that is the kind of money that you could probably sell your ticket for the, especially this Liverpool game coming up.
I've got one for you actually on this exact topic, because I have a cousin in America and who has a friend who is a Fulham fan and has been for many a year, I think after Dempsey McBride, and is coming over to the cottage, or coming over to London for his stag do bachelor party, and wanted to get five tickets to Fulham Liverpool. And I was like, well, you know, members go on sale first. You can try and become members, or we can wait and see what we can do when they go out. Obviously they went within a day to members, a lot of people obviously paying them off. And they were offered tickets at £250 each in the Johnny Haynes stand by someone selling them off, which is wild, right? Like, so if you're buying, even if you buy a membership, right, for one game, you buy a membership for this game, but just for this game, you pay £50 for the membership, say £100 for the seat, just let's be,
yeah.
And you say you make a profit off one game. That's the level we're talking about here. It just doesn't add up in terms of how it works right now. And I think that's incredibly frustrating.
Okay, moving on from that, just to end on a bit more of an up, this email from Stephen Marshall. And he is asking, is this the most Fulhamish season of the 21st century? I mean, define what Fulhamish means. But Stephen says, I can't remember another season with as many dizzying highs and lows. It's had everything. 4 points against Arsenal, the League Cup semi-final, a last gasp win at Old Trafford, two near miss losses and a draw versus Liverpool. 1 point from six against Burnley, losing by three to Brentford at the Cottage, Raul's spectacular Rabona and spectacular red card, the sale of Mitro and that window somehow being excellent with Iwobi and Bassi, among others, coming in, the drama of the almost sale of Polina, Jedi turning into one of the best fullbacks in the Premier League, 2-5-0 wins in a row, followed by getting beaten out of sight three matches in a row, Lukic and Tosin's renaissances, needless off-pitch issues, loaning in a striker in Breuer and him not getting a sniff because Rodrigo Muniz has scored 8 goals since the start of 2024. And I'm not sure yet, more twists and turns in the plot to come, with us likely playing a continued role in both the title and relegation races. What's your thoughts? Are there any others that can match it or come close?
Bravo, that's amazing. 100%. Yeah. Fantastic. In the words of Raz Prince from Phone Shop, expect the unexpected.
I'm trying to think if there has been a more Fulhamish random weird season. I mean, like, some of the kind of like dog days of the championship.
Yeah, that first one where we nearly got relegated because of T2 Lee Tomlin free kicks and then just randomly went and won three games in a row, having not won any games for like
and any
three
season
months.
That includes that Huddersfield game where Seko Fofana won it 2-0 and I think it might have been Sean Hutchinson that got sent off for mistaken identity.
Yeah. that was. But I think in as a whole, this one has a real claim, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Has a real claim.
It's been a ride. Yeah. Oh, that was what an email that was.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. I mean, it's been amazing for us because we've never been short of things to talk about. No,
exactly. Literally never short of things to talk about this season.
Can I just add as well? I wouldn't have it any other way.
Oh, 100%. What a stupid football club, and I love it unconditionally.
And I just think that, I think Fulham have got this kind of reputation as being this bit sort of jokey, sort of West London, sort of show busy, nutty club that, and I'm all for it. I'm all for it. It's one of the many reasons that I absolutely adore this football club. There's never a dull moment. There is never a dull moment.
We are silly.
Yeah.
Jack, what would you like to name the podcast?
I'm going to go for Ross McSweeney's Hollow Fulham Away.
Very good. That is brilliant. Well done, Ross. Hope you're well. Right, and that'll do for the podcast today. We'll be back on Monday looking at everything that happens in the Newcastle United game. Have a wonderful weekend if you're heading to the cottage. Enjoy. If not, I hope you're able to catch the match somewhere else and have a great weekend otherwise. Come on, you whites.
You whites.